There's a famous Chinese curse that goes like this. May you live in interesting times. And we might wonder why that would be considered a curse. And I think it's because if you have any knowledge of Chinese history, there have been successive waves of tumultuous social and political and economic upheaval in that country. And those would be pretty interesting times. But it points to a kind of life or a time of life when the forces at play in the world, political, economic, personal, social, environmental, if you will, are so huge and so unpredictable that we really don't have a sense of being in control. And the ground of our stability in life is pretty fragile. And so to have to live in a time that is tumultuous and unpredictable and very unstable is kind of a curse. But if you've been watching your mind this past week, we all live in tumultuous times, or interesting times, if you will, only in the sense that conditions appear in our life, our body, our mind, our environment, our relationships. It's not under our control. We don't choose what we get to experience. Stuff happens. And the way the Buddha put it, he said, there are these vicissitudes of life, pleasure and pain. And our minds and bodies just kind of swing wildly from pleasure to pain. So too from experiences of abundance and gain and wealth to experiences of loss and deprivation and difficulty. So too with being praised or approved or acknowledged in a self-inflating way. And times of being blamed and criticized, and these experiences just happen. We all wish for pleasant conditions in life. We all prefer pleasure, abundance, praise, renown. And we do what we can to achieve, acquire, experience, to get, to have them, and we try to avoid the other end of the spectrum. We try to avoid, and you've seen, no doubt, how much mental energy goes into strategizing how we're going to avoid physical and emotional pain, how we're going to avoid any loss of things or sense of self, and how we're going to avoid blame for anything, and how we try to protect our self-image in the face of inevitable criticism or deficiency. Now, while we know that life has its own unfolding, and we can't avoid swinging from pleasure to pain, fame and disrepute, gain and loss, praise and blame, we know that. We all know it up here. Every one of us in this room has experienced lots of pleasure, lots of pain, lots of recognition, lots of dismissal, lots of abundance, lots of loss. But just because we understand it at some level doesn't inoculate us to experiencing the pain, the disrepute, the loss, the blame. It doesn't it doesn't prevent us from experiencing it. And just understanding doesn't really give us the tools for navigating that terrain without suffering. What we're doing here in just trying to be aware, not trying to control life, but just trying to be open to all that life offers, acknowledge it, and see if we can establish a relationship or a response to conditions that minimizes suffering. That's what we're trying to do. What is happening in that process is we are really developing the qualities of mind that will serve us in those inevitable times of difficulty and challenge. I call it developing our contingency plans for the inevitable difficulty that's coming. I mean, we should plan on there's going to be pain in life, there's going to be blame in life, there's going to be difficulties in life. We should plan on that because, well, it will come. And the contingency plans for the dealing with the trouble ahead are the development of the paramis. And the paramis are, and I know many of you have studied with Gil extensively, the paramis. The paramis are the forces of purity in the mind. They're the forces of the purification of the mind being free of greed, free of hatred, and free of delusion. If I asked you to call to mind someone historical or in your life or contemporary or even mythological, someone who you consider to be a good human being, just think for a minute. Who would you pick? Just somebody, you know, that's a good human being. Not that they don't have their faults, but that they also have some recognizable quality as a good human being. If you look at what the qualities of those people are collectively in the room, who we pick, we would see that they are people who are kind, loving, generous, knowledgeable, responsive, truthful, patient, connecting. These qualities are what most sustain us individually and sustain us collectively in times of challenge. And the interesting thing is these aren't particularly Buddhist. They're not even particularly spiritual. And they're certainly not very esoteric. They're just good human qualities that any culture would recognize. People in any culture recognize kindness and patience and truthful and balanced and generous, loving people as good members of society. When the mind is temporarily or more enduringly and eventually completely purified of greed, hatred, and delusion, free of greed, hatred, and delusion, these are the qualities that are left. Kindness, generosity, honesty, understanding, love. This is what the Buddha undertook from the time he made the vow or aspired to become a Buddha and the many hundreds of lifetimes that he lived as a bodhisattva, perfecting the qualities of a Buddha. It was perfecting these paramis. perfecting these qualities of heart and mind so that they become the default setting of his mind in every situation. And when perfected, as a bodhisattva, he chose lives that would challenge him to be more patient, more honest, more loving, more generous, more. So that when the most trying situations, the most difficult situations, he could grow in his capacity to respond with these qualities of mind. Now, we recognize within ourselves these qualities also. We all have been generous. We've all been loving. We've all been patient. We've all been truthful. We've all been understanding. And so these qualities are not far from us. We have the potential. We have realized to some extent or in certain instances the capacity to be generous, to be loving. But we can also recognize that there's plenty of room for improvement because they are not yet the default setting of our mind. When faced with a situation, we still respond with aversion or anger instead of loving kindness. We still respond with miserliness instead of generosity. We still respond with deviousness or deception instead of truthfulness at times. And so we see that there is the potential in the mind to be more free of greed, hatred, and delusion. And while they're not yet developed fully within us, we do know the path to developing them is to acquire knowledge. How to be more generous, how to be more loving. But it's not just the knowledge of how to do that. We need to recognize the potential, we need the knowledge, we need the encouragement, we need an example, we need, well, a reason to want to develop these. And so we pay attention to our life. And many of you have reported in one way or another that, you know, in your practice, there is a process of kind of reviewing your personal history. You know, you kind of, the mind just kind of goes back and reviews things in the past. And you see situations and times and behaviors that, less than noble, caused you or others suffering. And right there we see. And we feel the suffering. That gives us a reason to want to practice and develop the paramis. And for many people in an intensive retreat situation, when we discover these painful places in our life, when we discover them, along with it comes an aspiration to try to do better. It's really important to acknowledge that, even though we may dismiss it as being unrealistic or not me, still there is a feeling of, you know, I'd like to do it a little differently next time I'm in that situation. And that is, you know, as we become more aware of that interest, it can become an articulated aspiration. And it's important for us to articulate our aspiration because we make decisions every day that lay down the tracks into the future, how we are going to experience the future. And if we're not careful with the little decisions we make each day, because we don't really know where we're going and we don't really have a clear idea of what we want, then, well, it'll only be luck that brings us to the end of suffering. But if we really see, this is suffering, this is the cause of suffering, this is my aspiration to reduce suffering, this is the decision I have to make now to do that. The process and the path of development becomes clear. And it's clear because we see it. We see it for ourselves through our own awareness. You don't have to read it in a book. You can read it in a book to get an idea. But when you see it in your own body and mind, the suffering, the relief, the possibility and the aspiration, it just takes recalling it. Recalling once again why we're doing this practice, what the benefit is, what the decisions are that move us towards fulfilling our aspiration. But this knowledge about what causes suffering and an aspiration to move away from it, we need to think carefully. We need to think intelligently. We need to reflect on how to do that. It takes active, intelligent reflection to turn the potential in the mind to a personal value. While we have the potential to be generous and loving, all of these paramis, and we recognize the value and we recognize it in others, to make it a personal choice and a personal value that we seek to fulfill takes reflection and commitment and a refining of how we can do that and why to do that. So if you want to think in your practice, or if you want to know the benefit of thinking, the value of thinking, this is it. Because if we think about these qualities and the value of them in our life, we can make the commitment to cultivate them in our life. When we do that, though, as we kind of reframe, cognitively reframe our kind of understanding of our conditioning, of where we've been and where we're going, we are going to confront our social, our political, our personal, our family, our cultural conditioning. Because our conditioning, while it may give lip service to these wholesome states of mind, doesn't always encourage them or even expect them or demand them. To give you an example, we live in a society that tolerates and rewards deception. Whether it's in advertising or political statements or whatever. And we see it all around us all the time. We see it's so common and so accepted, we almost don't even consider it harmful. And that's dangerous because we don't see it in ourselves. We're so tolerant of it outside in others that when we ourselves are less than truthful, what's the problem? Well, the problem is it causes suffering. So in confronting our personal and cultural conditioning, we are going to have to look at and let go of some opinions and some beliefs and some things that are tolerated socially, and we might put ourselves outside of the mainstream at times. And that's not easy. But to know how to navigate the transition from our conditioning to our aspiration requires insight. And not just the information. It's not just the intelligent reflection. We actually need to see it in action so that as we make the commitment and make our attempts to be a little more generous, a little more loving, we gain personal, insightful knowledge as to how to do that skillfully. While we all can say, yeah, it's great to be generous, and we all have lots of opportunities, often the opportunities that we have to be generous don't make us happy, and even our practice of generosity doesn't make us happy. Well, that's not very skillful. So how are we going to learn how to practice generosity in a way that makes us happy or joyful, except by paying really close attention and seeing what works? How does it work? And for this level, or for this kind of personal knowledge, you have to be aware. You have to be aware of what's going on before, during, and after, and all your thoughts, and all your feelings, and all your beliefs. And you got to kind of do a review. How did it go? Well, you know, 7 out of 10. Okay, well, that's good, but for it to be a default setting that brings joy every time, it's got to be a 10 out of 10. So that's why we're practicing awareness. That's why we're training in awareness, so that we can see what's really going on in our heart, where we don't deceive ourselves, we don't deceive others, we actually see the opportunities and take them. I was talking to somebody today, one of you in interviews, and we were talking about, you know, the techniques of practice may be like pay attention to the breath. Well, why do we pay attention to the breath? So that we can pay attention to the breath? That is not the reason. It's a tool for sharpening our attention, for developing a continuity of awareness, a clarity of awareness. And the purpose is so that we can see things clearly. Not just the breath, but so that we can see the opportunities for developing the paramis, so that we can see what really happens as we contemplate and practice the paramis. And that kind of self-honesty can only come through a strong, uncompromising awareness. So we use the breath, we use the body, we use sounds, we use changing objects in order to cultivate the clarity of attention that can cut through delusion. That's why we do it. So while the paramis are a potential within us, and through intelligent reflection may become a personal value, they're also a practice. And practice is just that. You practice. And through practice, we become better. Whether it's playing a piano or bicycling or swimming or diving or being mindful or practicing generosity. With practice and careful attention, we can refine our understanding and therefore move towards the happiness that all of these paramis as practices lead us to. In a way, you could say that all the paramis are happiness practices. Because when practiced correctly, with awareness, with understanding, lead to happiness. Now, the qualities that are called the paramis, generosity, morality, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolution or resoluteness, loving kindness, and equanimity, in and of themselves, well, they're just qualities of good human beings. What makes them a parami practice? Parami refers to perfection, the forces of purity, or perfecting the forces of purity in the mind. I'm sure you've heard that the Dharma, or the truth, or a truthful way of life, is carried on two wings, the wings of compassion or caring, and the wing of understanding or wisdom. And when these two are developed equally, then we're not compassionate without wisdom, or we're not wise without compassion. We act skillfully, compassionately. Well, just practicing generosity or patience or loving kindness doesn't make them a parami practice. It is when the motivation to practice them is to relieve you and others of suffering, to really free the mind, your own mind and the minds of others. Any of the paramis can be a great gift to share with another, and there will be some benefit. But when the motivation of it is more noble, more elevated, if you will, or has a more far-reaching possibility, then it becomes a parami practice. Ultimately, in our practice of the paramis, we're seeking understanding. We're seeking understanding of how these forces work in our own mind, how to develop them, how to practice them for the benefit of ourselves and others, and ultimately the liberation of all beings. And while understanding liberates the mind, letting go is the tool of liberation. And interestingly, we can look at these paramis as all practices of letting go, every one of them. Generosity is the practice of letting go of attachment, while letting go of material goods or resources or sharing your knowledge, it's letting go. Morality, or living according to the precepts, is letting go of bad habits, which sometimes are, well, pleasurable in a kind of a funny way. Renunciation is all about letting go. Letting go of a lesser good in order to acquire or obtain a greater good. Wisdom is letting go of delusion or ignorance. Energy is letting go of laziness. Patience is letting go of, I could just say impatience, but it's really my way or the highway. It's let go of it. And just to open up to, this is the way it is. Truthfulness is letting go of deception. Resoluteness is letting go of dissipation of mind. You know, the kind of the scatteredness of mind that can't really collect and get anything done. Loving kindness, of course, is the letting go of all forms of aversion. And equanimity is letting go of reactivity. When we see the paramis in this way, when we see these qualities of mind as all practices of letting go, we can see that these practices are all about the second noble truth. You know, the first noble truth is the truth of dukkha, which I elaborated on the other night. The second noble truth is the abandonment of craving, the abandonment of attachment, the abandonment of what we're identified with. It's all about letting go. And these paramis are all letting go practices. They're all practicing the second noble truth. As we come to the end of this time together in intensive retreat, we took a little time this afternoon, and we'll have a little more tomorrow morning, to really talk about how to bring the Dharma into our life, more. And it's not just about how can I sit more at home. We all have busy lives. And to insist on carving out 45 minutes in the morning or evening or in order to do a sitting practice, for many of us, it just doesn't make sense. To add one more thing to do in the day isn't going to make life any easier. And so the question inevitably comes up, well, what else can I do to bring my life more in alignment, more into harmony with what we see, what we value, what we practice here? And the understanding in Burma, where this tradition of practice comes from, is that lay men and women like ourselves who are busy with families and jobs and social commitments and civic responsibilities, the understanding is that while engaged in these kinds of activities, the practice of the paramis is the Dharma practice of choice, if you will. Now think about it. Is there ever a day goes by you don't have the opportunity to practice patience or the need to practice patience or loving kindness or letting go or understanding or generosity? We have opportunities for these practices every day. But we forget. And so it's a matter of bringing these 10 qualities into our mind more frequently, acting on them proactively, finding opportunities, but also recognizing the opportunities to respond with one of the paramis that will, in that moment, bring us right in line with being aware, being connected, and having some understanding of what's going on. And the understanding in Burma is, hey, do your parami practice for 10 months a year. And then understanding that the paramis are the foundation for liberation. To the extent that the paramis are developed, is reflective of the extent of the liberation of the mind, which you can see when you take an intensive retreat and you really see how much the mind is let go of. So, if you want to have, well, let's say, a better retreat in the future, practice the paramis in the meantime, because the paramis are the foundation for liberation of mind. I mentioned that all of the paramis are practices of letting go. And one of the paramis that we don't hear so much about is renunciation. Because renunciation is, well, it's kind of scary. You know, it's like, you mean I'm going to have to do without everything I like and want and find comfortable and somehow our mind goes from renunciation to deprivation. We hear renunciation and we think deprivation. And that's not what renunciation is at all. So I want to spend a little time on renunciation because, well, let's think of a role model for renunciation in our culture. I'm not sure we have one. Think about it. I mean, we don't have a lot. There are some. You know, Ralph Nader, some people say, and, you know, there are good people doing things. But renunciation and letting go, voluntarily doing without, not big in our culture. Nevertheless, it's all about letting go, which the Buddha said is the source, the key, the foundation for the most ordinary and the most sublime happiness. What's going on here? A couple of years ago, at the end of one of our month-long retreats on Maui, We have a lot of retreat equipment that we take to the facility that we rent, set it all up, and at the end of the retreat, we ask our local Sangha members to come help us unpack, you know, and repack all the kitchen equipment and all the bedding and all the futons and zafus and zabuts, all that retreat stuff, bring it back to the house. We put it in a couple of storage rooms, and it stays there till the next retreat. So at the end of the day, you know, there's half a dozen people that would have been helping me and Kamala bring everything back and store it. It's all packed away. And I looked around to see if there's anything left, and there's a few boxes of kitchen supplies off to the side. So I go rummaging around the kitchen supplies, and I lift out one of the items, and I said to my friend Duke, I said, "Duke, how would you like a box of wheat-free, dairy-free, sugar-free, tasteless, chocolate chipless cookies?" And he said, "There are some things in life I can do without." Well, the question for us is, what in life can we do quite well without? Because we don't often look at our life from that perspective. It's easy to see what it is we need, additionally need to live better, but we don't see so easily what we could live better without. And this is all about the practice of renunciation. When we come on a retreat like this, we take a period of time, and this whole retreat is the practice of renunciation. We leave our home, we leave our familiar distractions, our familiar habits, our conveniences in life. And it's a little bit rustic here. It's a little bit, it's not quite as cushy and comfy as home. Nevertheless, we find something here that is of value, and it has to do with our mind and how we're working with our mind, how we understand our mind, and how we're relating to the intimacies of our life. It's not about things and having and getting and becoming. It's about letting go of and seeing how much relief there is in that. Jack who said, going on a retreat is like going to the dump. You go to the dump and you just dump all your stuff. You just let it go, leave it there, and then go home and you're a little bit lighter. Well, it's like that on retreat. You just go, you just dump all your, all your pain, your emotional upheavals and your, your challenges and your fears and your, disappointments. You just leave them here. And you go home a little bit lighter. Well, only if we can let go. And so that's what we learn here, is to let go. The Buddha said, if by renouncing a lesser happiness, one attains to a happiness that is greater, then the wise will pursue that happiness which is greater. Oh. So, while we may already have some level of happiness and contentment and ease in our life, the Buddha is saying, if there's a possibility of even a greater happiness, a more enduring happiness or a subtler happiness, the wise person would let go of an inferior happiness or an inferior source of happiness to gain a source of greater happiness. So he's not saying just let go of the bad things. He's saying sometimes you have to look at your life and let go of things that make you happy, things that bring a joy or an ease to your life, because there's a greater happiness that's possible. So, Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche was a great Tibetan teacher of the last century, really just full of wisdom and compassion. And he has the best articulation of renunciation that I've seen. He says, renunciation implies the strong wish to free oneself not only from life's immediate sorrows, but from the seemingly unending cycle of conditioned existence. And with this renunciation comes a heartfelt weariness and disillusionment with the endless quest for gratification, approval, profit, and status. A heartfelt weariness and disillusionment with the endless quest for gratification, approval, profit, and status. I think every one of us in this room knows what that means. We've felt that. We've all had moments of kind of wishing we could just step off the treadmill. Whatever treadmill you find yourself on, of getting, having, acquiring, becoming more, bigger, better, faster, more recognition, whatever it is. And we just say, you know what? Where is this going? There's no end. And the wish to be able to just step off that treadmill is the aspiration to renunciation. And we've all felt that. We all have it within us. We all have that seed of renunciation. We all have the understanding already of the value of renunciation. So it's up to each one of us to recognize that. And to, while it may be just a flickering flame, a small seed, no roots, no growth to it, no fruit to it yet, but to recognize there's that potential. And then to find a way to plant that seed in our life and cultivate it so that we can enjoy the fruits of renunciation, which is a higher happiness. Now, I mentioned that sometimes when we hear the word renunciation, we think deprivation. But let me point to the experience of renunciation that we've all had that will disprove that, or will show you another way. Remember when you were growing up, and at some age you had your favorite toy or friend or sport or behavior, or something. And it was just the end-all, be-all of your life for a period of time, where you just, you know, you couldn't wait to get up in the morning, go out and play, or do, or, you know, get to the piano, whatever it is, you know, play in the band, or play the sport, or, you know, and it just was the source of your life, the source of your happiness, the source of your joy, the only thing that was meaningful for you. For a period of time. What happened to that? Where is it? Where's that sport now? Where's that toy? Where's that doll? Where's that ball? Where's that bike? Where's that behavior? Well, some of us still have it in the attic or the cellar, but it's not in our heart anymore. Our heart, our mind has let go. And for most of us, we didn't even notice. We didn't notice when we renounced that pleasure. That's how easy renunciation is. It's not painful. It's not doing without. It's not depriving yourself of anything. It's recognizing that this thing or this behavior or this belief no longer brings the mind happiness. Or there's a recognition that something else is better. And so the mind quite naturally just lets go. It doesn't hang on. It's not even painful, that letting go. It just goes quite happy to do so. That's renunciation. Now, it's easy when I say, well, remember a time in your early childhood and something you've let go of. Now I'm going to ask you to think of something in your early adulthood, something that you did earlier when you were an adult, some behavior, something, some something that you enjoyed. Where is that? Well, it's also gone. I used to be, well, some would say I still am, a deadhead. And, you know, when the Grateful Dead went on tour, so was I. And a lot of fun and satisfaction and other things. when that was my source of happiness. Then I got involved in the Dharma, and I was practicing for a few years. And one time, I had this, well, just amazing conjunction of conditions. I was going to do a 2-week retreat, the last day of which the Grateful Dead were playing just an hour away. So I said, what could be better? For 2 weeks, you go, chill out, calm down, sensitize yourself, open up, you know, then go to a show. Unbelievable. It was so painful. It was so loud and so stimulating and so unbearable. Well, I realized something. I'd outgrown the Dead. You know, while I still appreciated the music, I appreciated the Dharma more. Having let go of a lesser happiness, I was able to find a greater source of happiness, contentment, a sense of well-being in my life. It wasn't painful to let go of the Dead. It was a recognition that something else was better, or that the happiness was more enduring, more subtle. It was a sense of well-being, not just an indulgence in pleasure. I tell this story because we haven't stopped growing. But we may not have reviewed the attics of our mind. We may not have gone through the attics of our mind and discovered what we've actually let go of. And so we're carrying around this baggage of behaviors and beliefs and, well, former friends, if you will, and stuff that no longer serves our aspiration. We haven't seen that we've outgrown it. We haven't seen that we've let it go, and so we carry it around. It occupies a lot of disk space, if you will. And if we can free up that disk space, we have more opportunity for greater happiness. So again, part of the process of just paying attention to our life is really coming to recognize and acknowledge what we've outgrown, what we've let go of, whether it's beliefs or behavior or things or people or even ambitions or our future, how we imagine our future. You know, how you imagine your future when you're 25 or 35 or 45 is different than 55, 65, and 75. But if we don't consciously take a look, review, recognize that it's no longer where I'm headed, and intentionally let it go, then it keeps exerting a pull on us back to someplace we don't want to go. And so this careful and continuous awareness will reveal that to us. It'll reveal the pulls and the behaviors that, you know what, aren't serving us, aren't serving our highest aspiration. It's a form of renunciation. Awareness practice itself is a renunciation, a seeing and letting go in every moment. And only those that really come up as something to reaffirm as an aspiration, do we continue to follow? There's letting go of things. There's letting go of unskillful behaviors. There's letting go of obsessing mind. You know, to let go of things, outgrow it. Your intention just lets it go. To let go of behaviors, we practice sila. To let go of obsessive mind, we practice awareness. Put aside the defilements, the hindrances. To let go of delusion, we practice insight. They're all renunciation practices. They're all about letting go. Happiness is not gratification on the hedonic treadmill, as Kamala mentioned, but it is a sense of well-being. Happiness is a sense of well-being, not just pleasure. And what I've discovered in and through Dharma practice is that a sense of well-being is like the current of a river. And while the wind may whip up the surface of a lake or river, the current underneath is so powerful, it's not disturbed by the wind-whipped waves. And when the sense of well-being grows through awareness training and letting go, the ups and downs of life, the interesting times of life, if you will, the vicissitudes of life, the experience of gain and loss, pleasure, pain, fame, and disrepute, they don't disturb that sense of well-being. Temporarily obscure, maybe, but they don't substantially impact it. And so it's this commitment to the Dharma, the commitment to just awakening, the commitment to being aware, that establishes this base of stability in our life, so that the fluctuating conditions that, well, we really don't have any control over, don't upset our boat. And the interesting thing is, we don't even see it happening. We don't see this gradual development of this ballast in our life and in our mind. Because, you know, we've been practicing for a week. And mostly what we see is all the dramas playing out. You know, the ups and downs, and I like it, I don't like it, and the pain, and the fear, and the struggle, and the, oh my God, it's like, get me out of here. When's the retreat end? But actually, underneath it all is this growing stability, equanimity. And it's based on understanding. We really understand. This is the way it is in life. And we let go of our resistance, we let go of our fear, we let go of our demands that it be otherwise, and we see this is the way it is. And along with it comes this deep and personal recognition that, oh, it can be dealt with. Just like that. A couple of years ago, for the past 10 years, actually, we and our neighbors have been discussing and negotiating, designing and implementing a plan and an engineered project to bring a better supply of water to our properties where we live on Maui. And there's about 9 of us property owners, all sharing a small line now, and we got permission from the county water department to install a bigger line Of course, it was all our responsibility to design it and pay for it and to deed it over to the water department. In return, they would give us water meters, which allow us all to build barns and, you know, cottages and things like that. So, you know, the initial estimate was that it was going to be a couple hundred thousand dollars. Well, as we got going and got into the project and started building it, the price kept ratcheting up, and it was getting up around $700,000-$800,000, and we were all kind of going. So I called up the deputy director of the water department, and I said, you know, I'd like to have a meeting with you to discuss if there's any way that we can reduce the cost of this project or downsize it in some way so that we can afford to finish it. So I got the appointment, I went to see the deputy director, and he was there with two or three of his engineers. And I had a list of ideas, you know, 10 or 15 ideas that I thought we could discuss. So I handed out a list to all of them, and I said, well, you know, we have to build this tank, a 10,000-gallon water tank. You know, it's just to break the pressure in the pipe. Couldn't we do the same thing with a 1,000-gallon tank? So they had a discussion, and they referred to their, you know, their whatever they require. And after a few minutes, they came back and said, no, it's not possible. You know, section 2345, page XYZ says, you know, you need a 10,000-gallon tank. Well, that tank was costing us, you know, $250,000. And a 1,000-gallon tank was probably half or less than that. So he said, no. So I said, okay, well, you know, for a certain part of the length of the pipe, it had to be 8 inches. 8-inch pipe. Much more water than we'll ever use. So we said, well, couldn't we reduce the size of that pipe to just 6 inches? You know, it'll save us $50,000 or something. So they had another discussion. Blah, blah, blah. No, due to the location, the pressure, and the elevation drop, you need 8 inches. Okay. Well, how about that rebate? You know, you're going to give us we qualify for a rebate on some of the project that we install, that you give it to us over 5 years. Could you give us a rebate back in the first year? You know, and that'll save us, you know, $300,000 maybe. And they had another discussion. No, we've never done that before. We can't do that. So I could see where it was going, you know. And after a couple more topics, the deputy director, he looked at me and he said, you're old enough to know, and you don't need me to tell you, life's unfair. Well, I'm glad I had 30 years of Dharma practice. Because, you know, in an instant, you know, your mind goes rolling through incredulity. I mean, anger and resentment and just shock and awe. And it's like, you got to be kidding. He didn't just say that to me, did he? Yes, he did. Oh, my God. You know, and you know. It seemed like, you know, a half hour I was just kind of like stunned, wondering what I was going to say back. You know, probably it was all of 5 seconds, but it felt like eternity. And before I said anything back, my mind arrived at the place of, this is the way it is. And the corollary of, it can be dealt with. And that was the end of it. Well, I was as shocked as I'm sure they were, because where did that come from? Because in the moment, it didn't feel okay, and I didn't want it to be that way, and I didn't know that we were going to be able to deal with it. But that was a genuine response in the heart. It just says, well, do I want to suffer, or do I want to end suffering? It's that easy. But it takes a tremendous stability of mind not to get blown out of the water or out of the office, if you will, in that kind of situation. Where does that come from? Well, it comes from having seen this kind of intense, I don't like it this way, and I don't want to deal with it, and I can't deal with it, and having lived through years and years and years of practicing and seeing that in the mind and knowing that, you know what, you just sit there. And the dramas come and the dramas go, and you get all, you know, stirred up, and calm down, and you get elated and deflated, and you know what? All the time that that's going on, the ballast is just getting heavier and stabler, and the mind is just getting more balanced. More knowledgeable. This is the way it is. More able to handle the fact. This is the way it is. Life is unfair. And you'll see it over and over and over again. In your own life and in other people's life. Plan on it. It's okay. It can be dealt with. But to know that we can deal with it, we can prepare ourselves by developing the paramis. The paramis are the contingency plans for the unfairness of life. So let's sit, let the words settle down. If by renouncing a lesser happiness, the Buddha said, one could attain a happiness that is greater, then those with wisdom pursue that happiness which is greater.